Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
With respect to these tariffs, didn't Trump say just the other day, I don't care if the price of cars go up?
Right.
Didn't Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, the other day say, well, it's not all about getting cheap TVs? And Howard Lutnick, didn't he say the other day, well, if my mother-in-law had to go without her Social Security check for a month, no big deal. Could they be more out of touch? But it's literally an oligarchical government right now in that they don't really give two shits how it impacts right. The average working American. I grew up in a blue-collar family. My dad worked in grocery stores his whole life. My mom worked in restaurants. I can tell you something right now. If my dad missed a Social Security check, he would notice. If my mom couldn't buy a cheap TV, she would notice. And I think a lot of Americans right now are starting to say, wait a minute, what the fuckity fuck did I vote for?
Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast. Before we get into it, let me just tell you, we got a special guest today. I'm really excited to get Jim Acosta on the podcast to sort of unpack a lot of what's happening out there. You guys know Acosta. You know his background. Prior to becoming an independent journalist, he was CNN's chief White House correspondent, where he covered the Obama and Trump administrations. And we remember the drama in the Trump years, right? He is the author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America, and the host of The Jim Acosta Show on Substack, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. It's some really, really good, strong insights. I think you're going to enjoy this moment. So grab a little something special for the cup, sit back and relax and enjoy this conversation with Jim Acosta coming at you right after this.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Well, I've actually been looking forward to this conversation for a while. I've been an admirer and have mad respect for Jim Acosta, who we were talking a little bit before we hit the camera lights about, you know, just being that guy that's out there going, excuse me, you're full of shit. Can you help us understand the moment?
In not so many words.
Yeah. In not so many words. You know, he's the author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. And I think that title alone kind of sums up the work that Jim has been involved in and telling the truth. And I just want to welcome you, man. And I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Very kind of you. Thank you, Michael. Right back at you. A lot of respect for you and what you've done over the years, honestly.
Yeah, you know me. I tell people I'm just plug and play. I'm the biggest pain in everyone's ass. So that's what we do. So look, man, there's so many places to start. I mean, from the crap that's going on with Signalgate to the, you know, the massive tariffs that are now global. I mean, he just basically said, screw it. We're just going to put a tariff on everything and everybody. Dealers, you pick where you want to start.
You know, it's a great way to open up the conversation because we are sort of like drinking from a fire hose these days, and everybody is exhausted. People don't know where to start. I think the tariffs are a good place to start, in part because of what he and his own administration people have been saying with respect to these tariffs. Didn't Trump say just the other day, I don't care if the price of cars go up?
Right.
Didn't Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, the other day say, well, it's not all about getting cheap TVs? And Howard Lutnick, didn't he say the other day, well, if my mother-in-law had to go without her Social Security check for a month, no big deal. Could they be more out of touch?
Yeah.
Could they be more out of touch? I mean, if you had one person saying one stupid thing, that's one thing. We have three people saying three stupid things. There's a pattern. And Trump is playing with fire. He's playing with matches with these tariffs. And you have a bunch of billionaires running the government right now. It is literally an oligarchical government right now, in that they don't really give two shits how it impacts right. The average working American. I'm a blue collar kid. I grew up in a blue collar family. My dad worked in grocery stores his whole life. My mom worked in restaurants. I can tell you something right now. If my dad missed a Social Security check, he would notice. If my mom couldn't buy a cheap TV, she would notice.
Yep.
And I think a lot of Americans out there, Michael, right now are starting to say, wait a minute, what the fuckity fuck did I vote for?
Right.
Right. I mean, honestly.
Well, but you're absolutely right. And the thing that's a little bit frustrating for me, and it's something that, you know, I try to level up in the conversations I have on the shows I'm doing at MSNBC, is that very point. Can we focus on how real people are being impacted here? Because we can get lost in the weeds about the Washington thing. That's why I was telling Democrats, don't come protest outside of a federal building here in D.C.
Yeah.
Go to a school board meeting or go to the local Social Security office that just got closed.
That's right.
That's where you want to have the conversation because I love the way you put it. What the fuckity fuck is going on here is
well, and
is
Michael,
a perfect Acosta-ism. Let's start with that. But it does sum up, I think, the attitude that we're seeing reflected now in the town hall meetings that are taking place around the country.
You're damn right. And Michael, I mean, you know this all too well from being involved in party politics for years and years. There's a reason why Social Security has been described as the third rail of politics.
Yeah.
And I love how the Trump people come in and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, we're so immune because, you know, Trump beat every criminal case that was thrown at him except for the porn star case in New York. You know, he can walk on water. Nothing touches him. He's Teflon. So, you know, we could just grab Social Security. We can grab the third rail of Social Security and nothing will happen to us.
Nothing will happen.
Guess what, dipshits?
Yeah.
People are pissed off and they're showing up at these town halls and there are people saying, I went down to my Social Security office and I couldn't get a hold of somebody because they've laid off half the staff. I can't get people on the phone because they've laid off all these people. And guess what? You touch the third rail of politics, you're going to get burned. And so they're learning this lesson in real time right now. And the rest of us are just going along for the ride. I'm afraid that's what's happening.
How have you? So look, you come to all of this with legitimate bona fides, despite the bullshit you hear from Republicans in the House and the Senate. Publicly. You know, journalists like yourself have their respect because they know at the end of the day, you are fair. They may not like the story. Look, there are a number of reporters in this town that covered me over the years. And I'm just like, well, you're full of shit, but okay, it's fair. it's fair. I get it. I don't like the way you framed it, but you're fair.
Yeah.
And then there are those who are complete assholes and we know who they are, who are just trying. Tucker Carlson was one of those guys, and I can share some stories about my early days at the RNC with that mofo. But the reality of it is, you have that reputation along with a handful of folks. So it has got to be very interesting for you and journalists like yourself when you look at everything that's happening in and out of this Republican Party, and you know that member, that senator, there in that chamber right now is stewing in their own piss over this thing.
Yeah.
And they won't say a damn thing about it.
You're absolutely right. You know, I miss the old days of John McCain. You know, so talk about somebody who could dish it right back to reporters. He loved to do that all the time. He was so good at it. And I think he once said, you know, I hate you guys, but we need you. That was his attitude towards the press. And, you know, he was just so perfect on those things. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in the D.C. area myself, Michael. I grew up in Northern Virginia in Fairfax County. Tom Davis was my congressman growing up. The great Tom Davis, moderate Republican. He was just like a Jedi when it came to dealing with constituent issues.
Yep.
And he was the kind of Republican that I grew up with. I grew up with, you know, governors like Doug Wilder and Chuck Robb, very moderate Democratic governors in Virginia. So I didn't really grow up with an ideological bent or partisan stripe running through my veins. And I grew up in the era of Ronald Reagan. And so to me, that was always the Republican Party. And what it has turned into now is, I mean, there are lots of different things you can say about it. It's just downright depressing.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact, because I talk to them from time to time privately, they will just, you know, furrow their brow and put their head in their hands, and they will acknowledge what a train wreck Donald Trump is. But there's nothing they can do about it right now unless they want to jeopardize their seat in Congress. And you're just asking political animals to behave in a fashion that is just outside of what they normally do. You know, that's my estimation of it. And I think that a lot of them are just waiting to see if this passes and that they can just hang on.
I keep telling, it doesn't pass, folks. I'm not accusing it.
I'm just saying that's my
reason. You're exactly right. I get what you're saying in the way you're saying it.
Yeah.
For those Republicans, I keep telling them this doesn't pass. It becomes something. It metastasizes into something that you have. I wrote a piece recently, you know, going at Chuck Schumer, who was sitting there going, well, you know, this Republican Party, you know, we'll just wait until Donald Trump is off the stage. And then this Republican Party, you know, the Republican Party I knew will return.
Correct.
No, it won't. That thing is gone.
It's gone.
I mean, I say that as someone who's still inside the party. It's not. So guys like me are trying to figure out what is the next iteration of those Lincoln values that framed the Republican Party that you know, were sort of, as you mentioned, Reagan personified in the Reagan era. But even recognizing Reagan had his flaws and his issues.
Sure.
Starting his campaign in the heart of Mississippi to appeal to white segregationist men, the brightest moment to sort of end the 20th century with. But the reality of it is that party fundamentally, in terms of some of those underlying core values about the role of government and the opportunity of the American dream for citizens, still had some power to it.
Correct.
That's now morphed into all this Trump MAGA crap.
Yeah.
And so how do you peel that out, the remnants of that out, and reshape it and frame it and stand it up as a new set of principles is the challenge. But clinging on to Reagan's party or Eisenhower's party is a lost cause at this point. And those members sitting there in that chamber thinking that somehow, you know, the spirit of Reagan is going to rise again. It may, but it's going to be in a different form in somebody else's language and rhetoric who stands up and says to Trump, sit your fat ass down and be quiet.
Yeah. I'm waiting for one of those profiles in Courage. I mean, that's always been one of my favorite political books, John F. Kennedy, Profiles in Courage.
Yeah.
And we just haven't seen it on the Republican side. And Michael, I will tell you the way I see it these days is we have two political movements in the country right now. It's not Democrat versus Republican. It is democracy versus authoritarianism.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump is leading the charge towards authoritarianism. And let me tell you something. I wrote about this in my Substack over the weekend. He has some young people in that coalition, in that movement, who are very more than happy to carry that banner moving forward as soon as Donald Trump goes by the wayside, if and when that day comes. People like Stephen Miller, people like J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance, the vice president, going to Greenland and saying, we got to have Greenland. What in God's name is happening?
Right.
What is that? Stephen Miller over the weekend on social media saying, you know, the reason why we're doing what we're doing with immigration is because before, you know, cities were being conquered and towns were being pillaged. He was tweeting this stuff and it was absolutely bonkers, cuckoo for Cocoa Puff shit.
Yeah.
But there are true believers of this stuff in the party, and they're either just gaslighting people for grifting purposes, or they're gaslighting because it's the only language that Donald Trump speaks and they feel like they have to speak to the audience of one. Either way, it's a very disturbing thing. And to me, you know, there's just no question in my mind which side you have to be on. And that's on the side of democracy and freedom of the press and all of the things that are good and decent and that are baked into the Constitution. That has to be defended or we're in very serious trouble.
So that opens up then the lane for conversation around your book, The Enemy of the People. Talk about the dangers you encountered very early on in the first Trump term. In sort of being the guy in the room to held up your head and to go, does everybody see this guy has no clothes on?
Exactly.
Am I the only one? Hello. Dude, you buck naked, right? You know, so, but because
nobody wants to see, by the way, but anyway.
Right. No, we don't. Oh, no, we don't. We really don't. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Truth telling is a bitch in an environment where people don't want to hear the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you?
I wish somebody had told me that a long time ago. I wouldn't have gotten so much trouble. But no, you know, Trump, he hates two things really more than anything in the world. One is being told he's full of shit.
Yeah.
And the other is being told that he's a racist. And he just does not want to hear either one of those two things. And if you question him along those lines, you will incur his wrath. And, you know, he called the press the enemy of the people back then. He still calls the press the enemy of the people now. And the way I slice and dice it, and I try to present it to folks is, listen, you know, you might not mind it that much when he calls the press the enemy, but wait until he gets to your segment of society next. And look at the way he's gone after government workers now. I mean, federal workers are now basically his enemy.
Yeah.
Public scientists like Dr. Fauci, they were his enemy towards the end of the first Trump administration during COVID. He picks fights law firms right now. I mean, he's just going after law firms one by one these days. You know, he does this. He goes from one segment of society to another to basically make it clear he's the king. He's the dictator. He's the authoritarian. You shall not question him. And I saw a lot of this back in the day during the 2016 campaign. He would come into these rallies and he would call us all sorts of names, the despicable media, the dishonest media, the disgusting media, and so on. He whip up tens of thousands of people in these rallies to unleash their fury on the press. And they would come up to us after these rallies are over and call us traitors and so on. Towards the end of that campaign, they started to hire bodyguards for us during, that was in 2016. And of course, he continued to have these rallies and continued to do his thing going after the press, then started calling us fake news, then the enemy of the people. And, you know, one of the things that people don't really want to quite deal with is the fact that this is more than just an act, because, you know, you'll hear that from people inside his camp. Oh, don't worry, Jim, it's just an act and so on. Yeah. The problem is that his people, his cult, his following, they absorb all of that hatred and hostility, and then they direct it at the targets that he lays out. And that's why, you know, I and several others in the press corps would get death threats on a basically weekly basis. And this just became a part of my life to the point where, you know, my house got swatted, you know, there were people saying, you know, kill me and so on. You know, to the point where I, you know, I had personally have bodyguards, you know, during points of the first Trump presidency. That is the danger we get into in this country when he can go after people in that fashion. And I've tried to warn people ever since that first term that, you know, this is who we're dealing with. We're dealing with somebody who doesn't really have the American people top of mind. He doesn't have our democracy, the health of the Republic top of mind. He really just, all he cares about is himself, and anything that gets in the way, he's just going to roll right over that.
How do you advise your colleagues especially younger colleagues who are not, you know, newbie greenies, but those who are, you know, sort of in their third, fourth, fifth year, maybe came into the game in during the Trump first term. Now, you know, 4 years of Biden, got a little bit more seasoning in the tank. How do you advise they cover this term? Because I've been leveling up that question to folks whenever I get a chance, because the answers are all different, as you can imagine. And I think the example being exactly what you said, you know, what we see happening with law firms and then what we see happening, you know, with government employees. But there is a thread there that you can sort of follow all the way through the you know, first term and now. But what do you tell these younger folks in the middle of this craziness?
I mean, it's a simple message, and that is, you got to be tough. You have to stand up for yourself. I mean, this idea that he can kick the Associated Press out of the Oval Office and off of Air Force One, and then there isn't any sort of collective action on the part of the White House press corps to make that stop, to me, is insane.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, when a seat opened up in the White House briefing room in the front row, the rest of the press corps got together and said to the White House at that time, I believe it was during Barack Obama, and said, that seat needs to go to Fox News. And they got behind Fox and said, hey, Fox deserves to have that seat, and so on. And it happened. When I lost my press pass, when the Trump administration seized my press pass in 2018, all of the networks got together, major news organizations got together. Eventually, the WHCA, the White House Correspondents Association, mm-hmm. got their act together and got behind me to basically say to federal judge who was overseeing the case, this cannot stand. And the federal judge, who was a Trump appointee, gave me my press pass back. It takes collective action on the part of the press corps in order to stop this kind of madness. The idea that they can decide who's in the White House press pool every day is total lunacy. I mean, you saw that during the Zelensky encounter, encounter in the Oval Office, where you had people like the Associated Press kicked out, but he had Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend asking, why didn't you wear a suit?
Okay, first off, he's Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend.
And my question during that whole thing is, why is it that we only refer to him as Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend? Is that like at the top of the resume? Like, I worked at Dairy Queen is down here, and then Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend is here. And like, oh yeah, you can go in the Oval Office and ask the president a question.
Well, the reason you call him, because you otherwise don't know who the hell he is.
I don't know who he is. I don't
he's
know his name.
Nobody.
No, you know he's Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend. And to me, that is the astounding thing. That's what you get when you let the White House determine who is in the press corps, who's in the press pool, who has access to the president. You end up with this goofy sort of dystopian silliness that you would see in like countries where they have state TV, where, you know, they get, you know, the folks from the Russian state media to go in and question Vladimir Putin and so on. We can't have that kind of situation here in this country. This is the United States. We don't do that here.
Right. So it's funny, you know, in talking about truth, and certainly what you've written in your book, the fact that you have this situation now where Trump has decided to basically shut down Smithsonian institutions, and having them to literally whitewash American history, basically the experiences of the Native Americans, African Americans, Asian Americans in their coming to these shores now needs to be leveled up in a way that doesn't offend white sensibilities.
Yeah.
Well, let's be more specific here. White nationalists. Sensibilities, because a lot of the white folks I hang out with are sitting there, they're angrier than I am. Honestly, they're like, what the hell? I'm like, okay, we're gonna work it out, don't worry.
Yeah,
you're ready to hit the streets.
I hear you.
I tweeted out before we came on, Donna Brazile has a great piece up in I think it's thehill.com, and I just noted here, future generations will pay a price if we lie to ourselves about our history. Trump may want to sanitize U.S. history, but our embrace of its truth makes those words written on parchment 250 years ago actually mean something.
Yeah.
And for me, the core of I think this moment is one of confronting truth. You know, you and I grew up in the DMV. We are on the front row as witnesses to American history in so many ways.
Yeah.
Whether we directly or indirectly or not at all participated in the marches that came through our backyards, the conversations that were held on our front porch, we have this very unique appreciation of American history. We also, I think, appreciate the value of that history being shared and understood by all of us across the country.
Yeah.
This idea of truth telling, though, is at the heart of what makes history work.
No, it's true. Well, and it's one of the reasons why you've seen Donald Trump try so hard to erase the history of January 6th. And, you know, as I used to say when I covered him the first time around, we can't whitewash the white nationalism. You know, I mean, honestly, we can't.
You can't do it.
And this idea that you're going to historically cleanse the Smithsonian, as Donald Trump seems to want to do, it's an absurdity. I mean, you know, a lot of the white history, if he's worried about white history, there's the Washington Monument, there's the Lincoln Memorial, there's the Jefferson Memorial. I mean, there's a lot of white history on display.
Yeah.
You don't really need to get so sensitive about it. It's kind of all around us anyway. And the fact that you have a museum over here that specializes in this segment of our history or the Native American History Museum and so on, why are you getting so worked up over that? What's happening in your mind and your heart and your soul that you have to get worked up about this sort of thing? It sounds like you might have some issues to work through,
right,
President Trump. If this is on your mind, why is this on your mind?
Right.
The White House has had, he's the 47th president. We had one black one. I mean,
just one.
No women.
And look, and may not get another one for quite some time.
Might not get anything else but a white guy for quite some time. I mean, you know, like, so I just, as McCain used to say, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. This one is the one, the Kennedy Center thing I thought was cuckoo. And I thought, you know, the fact that he wants to take over the Kennedy Center and have the YMCA playing all the time and the Village People and Kid Rock.
But you know, it's no longer the Kennedy Center. They now refer to it as the Center.
it's
the Center.
They're living in their own kind of 1984 dystopian, you know, Disney world, kind of Disney world. But the Smithsonian thing, I think, should disturb people. And it goes to the issue that you're talking about. We as a society have to have a common set of truths. You can't have one segment of the society living in this information bubble over here and another segment living in this information bubble. It's just not going to work. And my sense of it is that going back to what we were talking about earlier about two movements in this country, the pro-democracy movement in this country, the people who are part of that, people like you and me, we're willing to listen to the other side. We're like, okay, yeah, this may help me get to what we call the truth. The other side, the authoritarian movement in this country, they don't seem all that interested in hearing from the rest of us. And and on top of that, they want to historically cleanse things like the Smithsonian. They want to take over and culturally cleanse things like the Kennedy Center. And the only thing, and it goes back to your question about what do they do with the White House Press Association. You have to be tough. You have to stand up for yourself. We have to stand up for what I describe as the American way of life. You and I grew up with this, Michael. And it is something worth defending. It is something worth protecting. If it means giving up our cushy gigs at certain places and just so we can continue to tell it like it is, and God damn it, that's what we have to do.
Yeah.
And this notion we can cut deals, like going back to our conversation about Republicans and Congress, cut deals or wait it out or make these compromises, it ain't going to work.
No, that period, folks.
It's just not going to work.
Not going to work at all. Jim Acosta, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you to solve, the question, what do we do with a problem like Elon?
All right.
We'll talk about that with Jim Acosta, the author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell Truth in America. Catch him on his Substack, The Jim Acosta Show, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. It's a great guy for a great conversation. We'll be right back with more.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, I'm John Fugelsang.
And I'm Professor Corey Brettschneider.
And we are here to tell you about The Oath and the Office, an essential new podcast about the extremely strange times we find ourselves in.
In the first few seconds in office, the President of the United States is required to take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And we're going to hold him to that pledge, despite the fact that he has threatened democracy and even the law itself.
It's all about hope for what democracy should look like and getting real about what our democracy does look like from an esteemed constitutional scholar and a deeply unqualified comedian.
Subscribe to The Oath in the Office wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. So we're having fun with my man, Jim Acosta, who is in a new space in his career and making, as we were going to break, talking about, you know, making a hard decision in order to have a honest conversation about truth, have honest conversation about what's happening in the country. I appreciate that very much. So here's one for you. Riddle me this. How the hell did we wind up with Elon? Couldn't he kick his ass in South Africa and he could be, live in his little apartheid bubble?
But even South Africa doesn't want that anymore.
They don't. That's the irony.
A long time ago. Yeah, thanks. We're not importing apartheid into America. That's not happening. Sorry. You know, Michael, it goes back to that Citizens United decision. I hate to say it. I talk about this on my show. Mm-hmm. When the Supreme Court cited the way it did in the Citizens United case and open up the floodgates of dark money, corporate money, super rich, wealthy guy money into the system, I think that really impacted our democracy in a way that we're still feeling now. When Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, can dump $290 million into Donald Trump's race back in 2024.
$26 million into the special election.
The Wisconsin thing.
Supreme Court in Wisconsin,
And Michael, how in the hell is it legal? You know this stuff back and forth and up and down. How is it legal that you hand out $1 million checks to people?
It doesn't sound
legal to me.
It's not. I mean, and the moment the Democrats this is the same Republican Party that pitched a bitch when you had states saying, okay, you can hand out water to people in line.
You couldn't do cookies. Remember in Georgia, you couldn't do cookies. You couldn't bring
cookies,
people water.
You can't have water, but I can hand your ass a $1 million check.
Somebody make that make sense. Honestly, we are living in a world where the oligarchs are calling the shots.
Yeah.
And, this people might be like, oh, you sound like, what is this, the resistance and all this shit? Give me a break. When Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, can hand out $1 million checks in a state Supreme Court election, in basically a local election.
Right.
I'm sorry, something is rotten in Denmark. And not to sound like J.D. Vance, but something is rotten in Denmark. And we got to put a stop to this. And remember last weekend, heading into last weekend, the attorney general in Wisconsin was going to the courts and saying, you know, we're going to do something about this. And out of nowhere, Elon Musk is like, oh yeah, never mind. It's if you sign a petition, then you get the $1 million. Right. It's like, you know, the hand got caught in the cookie jar. And so now I'm going to tell a different story. Sorry, we have to have rules of the road when it comes to our elections. It can't just be handing out checks.
You can't. And yet here we are. I fear that, well, a couple of things. One, the fact that the Wisconsin Supreme Court refused to take up the matter to definitively say, no, you can't do this, to me was very problematic.
Yeah.
And two, more broadly speaking, Jim, when you look at our own Supreme Court and a number of the issues that are working their way through the pipelines right now related to the firing of federal employees, the shutting down of departments that are clearly put together and funded and are there because Congress wanted them to be there. The narratives around areas like USAID, a lot of folks are still looking at the bulwark here being the Supreme Court, being our courts generally. How do you think that's going to hold up? How do you think that, you know, the lawyers are already capitulating.
Yeah.
Our judges next, I guess, is the question.
Well, and you saw the Chief Justice, John Roberts, put out that statement a week and a half ago or so and said, President Trump, he didn't mention him by name, but said you can't impeach judges because you don't like the way that they rule in certain cases. But I have to say back to Chief Justice John Roberts, what my mom used to say, you make your bed, you lie in it. Mm-hmm. The immunity decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court.
There it is.
Donald Trump and his.
There it is.
The green light to run roughshod over the rest of this country. And you know what? And Trump is going to do it. You hand him that kind of a green light, that kind of a blank check. He's going to go and do as much as he possibly can do. The Stephen Millers of the world, the Elon Musks and Steve Bannons of the world, they're going to run wild with that kind of stuff. And so, of course, the Chief Justice, you have to understand, you've emboldened the current occupant of the Oval Office. And, you know, and so it's going to be incumbent upon the Supreme Court, it seems to me, to act as a bulwark. To stop some of these shenanigans as these cases make their way to the high court. But at the same time, and it's not too fashionable these days to praise Joe Biden. But when President Biden left office and he gave that speech warning about an oligarchy coming forward in this country, and when he was out there calling for term limits for the Supreme Court, I thought some of that made a hell of a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can put people on the Supreme Court now in their 40s and hope they live 50 years until their 90s, it's just like this ideological arms race. Yeah. And you almost need like a timeout in this country where you're going to say, okay, you know, you can only serve for 20 years or whatever it's going to be. And then I think at that point, the parties might cool their jets and say, okay, maybe we'll just go and find the best people, the best minds to be on the court. I'm not saying the ones who were put on recently are not the best minds, but my point is you probably wouldn't have Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court or Brett Kavanaugh. You just wouldn't have.
You wouldn't have had those two, both of whom's biggest calling card was they had already promised that they would do
overturn
the pro-life thing.
Exactly. Yeah. That was
and that was, you know, the idea that, and for people to be so naive as to believe that, those conversations never happened. They never, said beforehand. Bullshit. I mean, they sat in front of the committee every last one of those appointees and lied. They perjured themselves.
They did.
Because
they're on the Supreme Court.
They said that stare decisis, what has
precedent.
Come, the law of the land, we respect tradition. It's all bullshit.
It's all
because
bullshit.
The first chance they could get to overturn precedent, they took it. And so you're right. I mean, I've always been of the view, hey, you know, let the, you know, Supreme Court is that, and our judiciary. I've always hated the idea of electing judges because then make them nothing more than a politician.
Exactly.
And so governors should be the ones, or state legislatures should be the ones putting people on the bench as representatives of the people of their cities, their communities, their states, and the country. But we do have elected judges. And to the extent that they have to run, then they need to run in the cleanest nonpartisan lane possible. And that certainly starts with not having some son of a bitch like Elon Musk dropping $26 million into Elon Mustang couldn't tell you where Wisconsin was.
Exactly.
I mean, let alone.
He was coming out. Did you see him coming out the other day with the cheese head on and he's jumping up?
Look at
he's doing that jumping up and down dance again. I'm like, what's that jumping up and down dance thing, man?
He's a 10-year-old. I mean, he and Trump were 10-year-old boys who owned their corner of the playground and have now expanded that reach to the rest of the playground. And here we are. We're watching these idiots jump up and down. Donald Trump sit there, do that dumbass. They can't dance, never could dance. And now you got all these white folks running around like they're having seizures trying to imitate Trump dancing. I mean, what the fuck is your problem?
I know. And the YMCA, I'm sorry, this is not a wedding back in the 1980s. You know what I mean? Like, can we find some different...
I know that's a gay anthem, right?
Well,
hey, Republicans, you know that's a gay anthem, right? You guys, you remember, you didn't get that part?
I don't think he realizes that if they're going to have this problem with the Kennedy Center, he should... Yeah. But I mean, but the other thing too is, like, our democracy should be insulated against this kind of crap. Honestly, it should be insulated against this kind of Elon Musk bullshit. And the idea that, you know, they're going to go after you if you do anything at a Tesla dealership, you're going to be a terrorist and we're going to send you, you're going to be out of here and all. I mean, they're just bending. It's like they're bending the knee to Trump, bending the knee to Elon Musk. Elon Musk has no business having this much power and influence in our government. He just doesn't.
How many federal contracts right now? He's basically blocked and tackled Blue Horizon out of the space race
because
he controls the space game now. He's going to be the one to declare Mars for Trump or him or both. You know, his rockets are blowing up on the pad. So, dude, focus on getting your rockets to stop blowing up.
Or your Tesla stock prices stop dropping. You know.
Right, the Tesla stock prices. And could you design a car that doesn't look like a piece of shit? You know, can something, I mean, what the hell?
I remember because I went to Fairfax County Public Schools. We would have shop, you know, you had shop class.
Yep.
And and one of the special projects of the shop class was we made this toolbox out of sheet metal. And I think my mom might still have this in her garage or in her attic or something, the sheet metal toolbox. I swear to God, looks like the goddamn Cybertruck. The sheet metal toolbox that I built in the eighth grade and shop at Poe Intermediate in Annandale, Virginia. It looks like a goddamn Cybertruck. It does.
Well, that's what happens when a 10-year-old designs the car.
That's a good point. That's a good point. It's a little strange, a little rough around the edges.
That's it.
Not going to catch me in one of those things.
No, not ever. Not ever. So let's move from the domestic space to the foreign policy space. You have covered that area as well. What's your down and dirty on the play right now with Ukraine? You had Trump recently being very, quote, very angry, pissed off even at Vladimir Putin, because the way they, you know, went about doing this whole, we're negotiating this settlement. And Vladimir was like, that's not what I told you on the phone.
Yeah.
Dude, that's not what I told you. Right. You know, what do you think how this ends up?
You know, this is one of the most important questions that we all face right now is what happens to Ukraine. And because you can't, it's not a stretch to say if Ukraine falls, that Vladimir Putin is going to go after a NATO country. And if Vladimir Putin goes after a NATO country, what does Donald Trump do then? Right. My guess is if it's one of the smaller Baltic states or Moldova, he's just going to let that go. So then that means that NATO really doesn't exist anymore, that it's a paper tiger. And that creates a much more dangerous world. It says to China, you can do what you want in Taiwan. Apparently, the Chinese were just making some some comments about the Taiwanese leadership just in the last day or two, making some very hot comments that you don't typically hear out of Beijing. And some of that's pretty some worrisome stuff. And so the world becomes a lot more unpredictable if we continue to go down this foreign policy path that Trump has laid out. Now, to some extent, trying to get both parties at the table to adopt some sort of ceasefire or a cessation to fighting and so on, sure, a lot of that makes sense. Everybody would like to see the war in Ukraine end. But it can't happen without Zelensky at the table. It can't happen without the Ukrainians at the table in earnest. And this idea that Trump and Putin can create some kind of deal without Zelensky and the Ukrainians at the table is just not going to happen.
How do you do that, though, Jim? I mean, they all gathered in Dubai or wherever they were. How do you have a meeting to talk about a ceasefire between two countries?
Yeah.
And not have the country that was invaded in the room, let alone at the table, but in the room to have that conversation. And the rest of the world seemingly look at that and say, well, we hope something good comes out of that. Nothing good can come out of that when you've got clearly the U.S. siding against its ally, taking up the Russian cause. Because Trump has his head up Putin's ass.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is NATO are alliances that have looked to the U.S. to be that stabilizer, the one that would come to the table and say, okay, both of y'all need to come in the room, sit down, and we're going to work this out.
Yeah.
That's gone. So does Europe step up? I've been begging that question for the last
I think that's what you're going to see happen, Michael. I think you're going to see, and there was some talk of Trump-proofing Europe and so on before Trump came back into office, and I think they're going to continue to try to do that work. Emmanuel Macron has talked about this, a new security posture for Europe, and Keir Starmer, I think, is of the same mindset, may want to do it a slightly different way, but I think that is what you're going to see evolve over the next couple of years, because you said it, you nailed it right on the head. Honestly, I've talked about this time and time again. At every turn, Donald Trump sides with Vladimir Putin. You can barely cite a scenario where Donald Trump does not take Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin's side in things.
Right.
And it's just the damnedest things. I was in Helsinki when that whole debacle went down, when Trump said that he trusted the Russians more than his own U.S. intelligence community in terms of the assessment as to whether the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. There's just something weird and quirky and funny that is going on between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And maybe it'll be the Scooby-Doo mystery that finally gets solved one day. We'll find out. It's old man Withers.
We're going to find out.
We're going to find out what the hell is going on with those two.
Yeah.
But it seems to explain quite a lot. And to me, that's the whole ball game right there. When we figure that out, it's going to explain a lot.
Yeah, I think part of it, a kernel of a seed was planted in terms of the answer to that question by his son, which one? Not Junior, Eric, who bragged during the 16 campaign about how much the Russians had funded so many of their projects.
That's right.
From their hotels, so some of their hotels in New York, to certainly a lot of their overseas financings for their golf course in Ireland and their golf course, here or there. And it got me to thinking at the time, I was like, well, if the Russians are putting up the money behind all of these projects that Trump seemingly has in play, and his desire to open a hotel in Moscow, Trump Tower, Moscow, which is still a driving thing for him.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, once they sized up that weakness in the man, just the sheer promise of, you'll get your hotel.
It's called leverage. And he knows this all too well. And the other aspect of this, Michael, is, there's been this theory that's been put forward by people who want to look past the leverage thing and the business side of this. And they're just wondering whether Trump and Putin and Xi just sort of have this spheres of influence mentality that, that Trump will control the Americas and Putin will have his, control over parts of Europe and Xi will be able to reign over parts of Asia. And that's really what's going on here. These three guys, I think that might be part of it, you know, kind of a czarist view of, you know, these spheres in the world and so on. But damn, if there's just something else going on. And I just wish we could figure that out. And I think that's where Zelensky is in so much trouble right now, because, you know, one of the things that I will tell people, because I've had some firsthand experience with this, the Ukrainian people have just been so brave and courageous through all of this. It would just be a crying shame to throw them to the lions. I mean, on my old show, I had a couple of fighter pilots on, Moonfish and Juice. Those are the names they went by because they couldn't go by their God-given names. Right. The Russians would go find their families and kill them. And I interviewed both of them. Both of those pilots are dead. I interviewed another Special Forces soldier, a woman, who was on my show. And she was blown up in an IED explosion and somehow lived. She somehow lived, Adriana. She came on my show one time and brought me this steel coin that was made out of the steel of a blown up Russian tank. And I'll never forget that experience, meeting these brave Ukrainian people. And to think we would turn our backs on them and screw them over in this fashion. It's just un-American that we would do that.
Well, to your very important point, they should remind us of the once fabled patriots who refused to succumb to the harsh wishes of a rogue king of England. And they decided to stand their ground on this little tract of land that would become a very powerful nation. And you hear that a lot in the voices, not just of Zelensky, but of the very people you just described. Yeah. Those men and women, those grandmothers who are standing there, where do I need to aim, right? To defend to defend their block.
Yeah.
To defend their neighborhood.
And the Russians abducted those children, those Ukrainian children, and took them over the border into Russia to turn them in. What kind of monstrous, crazy ass Nazi shit is that?
Yeah.
How can we possibly be on the other side of the equator? We have to back these people. It's just there aren't two sides to that. There aren't two sides to a story when it's a matter of right versus wrong. That's the side we should be on as Americans. And to think that we would just throw these people away out of expediency or for some rich minerals deal or so, you know, that's all horseshit compared to what the heart of the matter here.
And the Republican members of Congress who now have sided with the evil empire, have sided with the Russian bear over the freedom of individuals like the Ukrainians should be ashamed of themselves. I mean, they're pathetic little wimps who don't have a ball among them to stand up to the bully on the playground and tell him, no, we're not this. This is not who we are. But then maybe Jim, for Republicans, this is who they are, that we finally have the covers peeled back. And we realize, and it's a revelation, and it's a little bit of a personal challenge for a lot of Republicans like myself, who, you know, were fighting some of these urges and these efforts inside the party, paid some coin for that in terms of, you know, the price that you pay for trying to stand up against it, but seemingly still were able to move the party along.
Yeah.
But then maybe, you know, the party just got to, they got to Trump and they said, we don't have to go any further. This is who we are. That we are, at the end of the day, a bunch of neo-Nazi loving white nationalists supporting, you know, Christian nationalist assholes who love doing what we're doing. So we don't have a problem having the Russians take kids out of their family, from their home country, and send them off to Russia to become Russians.
I don't know. There's a price to be paid, though, right? There's a price to be paid when we don't stand on the side of good, when we don't stand on the side of humanity.
It's a dear price to pay.
And that's what I worry about. And that's why it gets back to, we just got to stand our ground for this American way of life that you and I grew up with, Michael. You know, we got to hand off to the next generations some semblance of the America that we grew up with, or we're just utter failures as a generation. as generations of Americans. We're not the greatest generation. We're the worst generation.
We're the most. I've claimed this generation is the most selfish in American history, because we whine about everything, we complain about everything, and we're so put upon that we don't have time to look at the neighbor who is struggling, who is homeless, who is hungry, whose kids are in trouble.
And they just grab some guy off the street in Maryland and send him down to El Salvador. And then they say, whoops, sorry.
And we can't get him back. I don't know what to do. And this is who we are. I'm going to let you go after this one. But I was very struck by your words with my buddy Charlie Sykes in that podcast interview where you're asked about what makes you hopeful. What makes you hopeful in light of everything we talked for the last 50 minutes? It wasn't a whole lot of hope in this conversation, but there's still hope. Yeah. There's still hope out there.
I think there is, Michael, because I think that there are enough of us who care about, you know, the things that you and I have talked about, you know, preserving and protecting the American way of life, that we're going to get through this. And I know people are down in the dumps right now and they think, how in the hell can we survive this? You know, this country has survived some pretty incredible tests. And I do think we're going to make it through this one. It's going to take a lot of, you know, bucking each other up like you and I have been doing during this conversation. But I think we can get there. And, you know, and I was saying to Charlie the other day, maybe it's because the implosion is going to be that satisfying when we get to the end of all of this. And we'll all say, you know what, that Acosta guy, he was right. This was so spectacular that now this has made everything not that fucking horrible. But hopefully that'll be the case. I'm a foolish optimist. I'm a glasses half full optimist. I go around, you know, you go around to the grocery store, out to dinner, and you talk to people. And like you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, they shake their heads and they tell you that they can't take it anymore. There are just enough of us pissed off cowboys and cowgirls out there that I just think that we're going to get through this. And yes, he got in there by, a couple of million votes and a couple of 100,000 votes in this state and that state. There's no mandate. There was no tsunami. There was no landslide. Barely got in there because the economy was not that great and inflation was not that great. And he just kind of snuck back in there because Joe Biden took too long to get out of the race and Kamala Harris didn't have enough time to introduce herself to voters. It was sort of a perfect storm that landed his ass back in there. There's no question about it. That doesn't mean everything is going down the toilet. So you just need people to just stay strong. For Christ's sake, our parents and grandparents, they went through a hell of a lot more than what we're going through right now. Although you're right. It is rather stark and depressing at times, but I just think that there's more to us than this. There's got to be more to us than giving up on the Ukrainians and giving up on grandma and letting her social security get ripped away. We're just not that country. I don't think it's going to happen.
There's more to us than giving up on us. I like that. My man, Jim Acosta, this has been a real treat for me, man. I've watched you from great distances. We've seen each other around town from time to time, but it's really nice to spend some time with you and to get inside your head a little bit on all this stuff. The book, folks, The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Catch Jim on The Jim Acosta Show on Substack, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. It's a great listen and great engagement. Jim Acosta, thanks, bro.
Good to see you, Michael. Thank you so much. Great talking to you.
You got it. All right, folks, that does it for our little bit of time together. As always, I appreciate you when to do the download thing. Check us out on the Bulwark platform. We love you there. And until next time, just stay away from stupid. That's all you have to do. It's not hard. Just do it. You know, like Jim said, you know, we're better than that. And we don't hang with stupid because we're better than that. Take care.
Good deal.
The
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.